Thank you, Julie. And it's a great segue, so thanks for teeing us up so well. So as you'll see, our work really parallels nicely with the previous presentation, and we have yet to formally meet them, so well done. Ours represents Washington, D.C., so it's a collaboration between the school district in Washington, D.C., as you'll hear, all their public and public charter schools, along with the university we represent, which is American University. And the health issue we're dealing with, similar, was childhood obesity. So in the next 20 minutes, we're going to give you a little bit of overview of our Healthy Schools Act, as well as our mission and how we relate to the schools, as well as the State Board of Education. So the district is a little funny because it's not only one district, but has a State Board of Education, which is referred to as OSSE, the Office of the State Superintendent. So just to, and we've heard this term, I'm sure that many of you have been in other sessions where community-based participatory research has been shared, but I just thought I would contextualize the importance that we believe CBPR really brings to our collaboration with OSSE to benefit the schools and actually to benefit the students who are attending those schools. So we look at applied collaborative approach. What this means for faculty members is many times they have to leave their authoritarian role, which we have in a classroom, outside the door and really work towards equal partnerships. We look to social change to improve community health. And in an earlier session we were just looking at, we're looking at reducing the silos between health and education, which many times are siloed. And so we're looking also to increase community participation. So not only from the institution that we represent as well as the state, but we want community participation with nonprofit organizations, school board members, as well as family members. So our school health policies are being established and implemented to respond to childhood obesity rates. As we know, childhood obesity rates are on the rise, as adults are as well. And schools have been tasked as a natural setting to reach the schools or to reach the children. And what we're seeing as a result of Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act is that policy is leapfrogging over the research. We've yet to identify what are the best practices for addressing childhood obesity, but we've gone ahead and established these policies, implemented them, and are trying to identify those strategies as we go along. We're going to explain to you the D.C. Healthy Schools Act in just a moment. So D.C. is a unique place. It is divided by wards. So we have 8 wards, and although it's maybe hard to see, American University sits up in Ward 2, which is on the left-hand side. Tends to be a little healthier of a ward, and has higher socioeconomic, whereas a lot of the work that we do, and I'll recognize our alum, Jess Young, who will soon be Dr. Young from Johns Hopkins, but she started us out working, too, in Ward 7. Ward 7 and 8 have the higher poverty, higher crime rates, higher unemployment, and so these are more of your higher need schools. The school district has about 88,000 students. About 40% of them attend charter schools. So 60% are in the D.C. public schools. About 21% of all school-age children in D.C. are categorized as overweight or obese. And about 30% of the D.C. children receive the majority of their meals at school, which means breakfast and lunch, which is traditional, but also snacks as well as dinners. So the D.C. Healthy Schools Act. As we've said, all schools around the country are required to have a school health policy. In 2010, D.C. Council, different than the Board of Education, but the D.C. Council passed the D.C. Healthy Schools Act. And this is a lot of provisions. The provisions are very much centered around food health, but they're also centered around farm-to-school programs. And underneath the school, the first block, you'll see in the fifth and sixth bullet, you'll see that physical education and health education time. So physical education is 150 minutes per week, and requirements for middle school is 225 minutes. So I might caution you that these are lofty provisions and sometimes very challenging for schools to meet. Farm-to-school programs are more popular, and then at the very bottom is creating this culture of health where schools have their individual school wellness policy to engage community members, families, and PTAs. The one note here is also is there is a reporting function. So in participating in the authorship of the School Health, the Healthy School Act, we implored DC to include a school health profile to measure the implementation of the provisions of the act. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to my colleague Sarah to jump in.
So thank you again for having us here, and I feel a little bit like Professor Hightower King, because I am also a special education to disability work, so I'm so pleased to sort of be snuck in as an educator to listen to the wonderful work that's happening here at APA and just listening what my colleagues in health are doing. So in our project here, we work with the Office of the State Superintendent of Education and use data that they collect annually called the School Health Profile at SHP. And it's a mechanism that the Office of the State Superintendent collects. It is aligned with the Healthy School Act, and it's a self-report instrument, so there's some limitations relative to the usefulness of a self-report instrument, but it is compiled to look at the degree to which the strength of the policy, too. So again, to follow along with our colleagues, the degree to which the policy is being implemented with some degree of fidelity. The profiles completed by the principal are typically some sort of designee in the school, depending on what the school is like and how the school is set up. It could be a vice principal, it could be one of the teachers, it also could be a member of the school wellness council. And what we tend to do is we tend to look at school-level information relative to implementation of the Healthy School Act. And again, talking about our collaboration both within the university and also with the school partners as we look at some of the academic outcomes for the kids. So we're using this school-level data at the school health level, but we're also looking at student academic performance, again, also at the school level. So the school health profile allows us to ask a lot of questions about what's going on relative to school. The school health environment, and to be honest, there's a lot of questions that have something to do with something that somebody was particularly interested in relative to the politics of Washington, D.C. You'd be really surprised that politics is also local in D.C. But what we try to do is we try to collect, try to analyze the data based on two different issues. One, we use something that we're going to talk about today, which is called the school health compliance score. So it looks at the degree to which the school is actually implementing the requirements of the school health, the Healthy School Act. Again, there are other questions on here, but we wanted to narrow this. So we have a school health profile that looks at particular elements of the policy, including, for example, minutes of physical education or the degree to which they're getting farm-to-school activities in the school or the nutritional implications of what's happening. Again, all aligned with the Healthy School Act. We can also ask kind of a more broader question, and although we're not going to get into a lot of detail on this particular part of the talk, we're also talking about school health environment issues. And these go a little bit more broad into the whole idea of what's happening in the school, you know, whether it has something to do with teachers or whether it has something to do with the environmental issues that the kids are grappling with. So again, this tool gives us an opportunity to slice up the policy in a bunch of different ways. So these are not the easiest to see little bar graphs, but if you can just look at them and maybe squint a little bit, or I can just tell you. These are the means of scores for schools relative to their compliance score. So the mean is around 22, and then you'll have schools that, in theory go all the way up to 30, and then some schools that are reporting somewhere around 15 or 16 of the points. So again, most schools are getting points because of the nutrition. There's a centralized school service programs that support both the public charter and the traditional public schools. And so most schools get the points associated with nutrition because they're using those providers. Where they're not getting points would be in areas where, they're just not providing the physical education or they're not providing the different community outreach sort of work. So those are the types of things. So in terms of our analysis, and again, this is not the main focus of our talk. We want to talk more about the partnership, but we did want to share with you kind of what we're finding. And again, the big key here is what we're finding is we're trying to not only tell the story of what's happening with the implementation of the Act, but what's the relationship to other outcomes in the schools that the principals are really interested in hearing about, is how are our kids doing in reading and math. So this is what we're trying to look at. So what we did is we analyzed, and one of our partners on the proposal today is a woman named Betty Malloy, who's in our math stats department, and she helps us kind of figure out these different types of analyses. You know, just like you guys, we have somebody fancy who can do the HLM stuff, and we just believe her, and it's fantastic. So what we do here is we try to take the school health compliance scores based on those schools that sort of get the bottom level of scoring, and then we have a middle group and a top score. So one way to demonstrate that to you is just some quick little box and whiskers plots. And what's interesting here on this particular chart, if you just look at those dark mean lines, these are the scores of schools at that middle, bottom, and top groups. This is the relationship to their scores and math scores. So this is the No Child Left Behind provisions of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act require us to be accountable to students' health, to students' performance in academics, particularly in reading and mathematics. I know that was a mouthful, but that's actually what it's called. It's the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. You know it as NCLB. But the point being is that what's interesting and happening across the country, but also in Washington, D.C., is in urban schools, we're seeing an ongoing growth in mathematics. And it might be for a lot of different reasons. It might be that math is easier to teach, probably not, but it's also potentially easier to assess. And so we do see standardized test scores in mathematics across the country actually going up before they go up in reading. So it's an interesting thing that's happening. But what you see here is a very simple relationship. Schools that are scoring higher on the Healthy School Act are performing higher on this mathematics assessment at the end of the year. So it's, again, a very one-to-one relationship, but it's, again, one of those things where we can go to a principal and say, hey, it looks like provisions of the Healthy School Act are somehow, we can't really tell you how, related to kids' performance in mathematics. This is another way of showing those same data. This is a regression line that basically all of those dots there are the 300-some schools that are providing data relative to the Healthy School Act and also relative to their kids' math scores. And again, you do see a slight positive relationship. And this is the 2014 data. I'm also going to show you some more complicated data just beyond the compliance score. Same data as I was presenting before, but on reading. And again, you see that kind of clear relationship between schools at the middle and bottom quartile or bottom and middle quartile relative to reading. The reading outcomes for the groups that are scoring the highest in the Healthy School Act are not, you know, predictive of their scores on the reading test. But again, it might be that the reading takes a little bit longer to catch up on in terms of students' outcomes. That's what I'll suggest to you today. Another way to look at these data, and again, this is a little bit of a messier sort of plot, but what we ask the question of is, you know, what specific elements of the Healthy School Act are really having some degree of relationship with kids' academic performances. So this particular graph shows the answer to the question of, is it have something to do with minutes of physical education? Now realize that this is minutes of physical education, it's not minutes of physical activity, so it's not necessarily measuring that specific thing. But we do find, and now here you have 2 years of data that shows a relationship between kids' math scores in 2012 and 2013, and their same minutes of physical education that were available to them. So again, you do see a positive trend in that particular piece.
I might add to that is, if you'll remember when I talked about the provisions, anyone remember how many minutes the DC Healthy School Act required? 150 for elementary. But you can see they're all clustered down to 45 to 50. So we're really not in compliance. We're only getting by about a third. So you can still see we have a long ways to go with implementing that provision. And it's hard to get schools to commit then from 45 minutes, as you folks probably know, three times as much. So that's a real challenge for the schools, even though the DC Council, you know, does oversee the schools. So it's a challenge. But I just thought I'd connect those facts.
And again, this is the same data, this time showing you the reading scores. So again, as Stacy mentioned, you said that sort of cluster of schools around 40 minutes of physical education. And then again, you see a same sort of relationship between that and reading. Another thing that's sort of interesting to point out, and actually I'll point it out, I'm going to go back a couple of slides maybe it's fine to show it on this one. I mean, what's interesting here is if you look at the dots, you know, the red ones are there's red dots and there's blue squares. And basically what I want to show there is what's particularly interesting, you might be wondering based on Stacy's slide before, is the socioeconomic basis of, you know, these scores, where are kids kind of interestingly falling down. And what's interesting, you can't perfectly see it on this particular chart, but there's almost a U-shaped trend of, it's a U on its side here, but a U-shaped trend of kids at the highest socioeconomic level and the kids at the lowest economic level. So again, if you're at a very poor school, you're more likely to perform well on the Healthy School Act, and if you're at a very wealthy school, you're interested in performing, or you are more likely to perform well on the Healthy School Act. And what's interesting here is that if you're at a very low socioeconomic school, more kids are getting free and reduced price lunch, you're actually more likely to have more programming coming in. So there's a group of schools in the middle that are not, you know, achieving the elements of the Healthy School Act, and they're not achieving an academic. So just another interesting kind of question to put in your head about how we do that. Just some of our kids eating, this is one of the taste tests that the students in our program we're doing, so we just kind of thought we'd have pictures of actual children and actual people doing things. This is at one of our public charter schools where we were doing sort of a parent involvement, and again, one of the things that's really powerful about community-based participatory research is it's actually the students at this public charter school running the food taste test and the parent information session. So I know I only have 5 minutes left, so I'll just quickly mention this piece about our ongoing research and where we're particularly trying to go is we're bringing in more folks into our School of Education, Teaching, and Health who are interested in the cognitive underpinnings of performance. And, you know, the neuropsychologists tell us that the brain has something to do with learning, so we're believing them on that. But they're also, as we know, healthy eating has some effect on the brain as well. So we're trying to look at some research that will attempt to kind of step into what's the relationship between cognition and cognitive indications and both health and academic performance. So that's sort of where we're going, and this chart tries to talk about that quite a little bit. We also have different aspects. One of the things that we're trying to do, as I think the group before, the Indiana group was talking about before, is we're also trying to get teachers involved, and if teachers can serve as role models in terms of, you know, doing their own walking clubs and checking in terms of their own health, but also doing that cross-curricular work. There's really interesting areas where the Common Core education standards, by the way, give you this opportunity to ask questions about nutrition and where does food come from and be analytical about your own health status. So with that, I think we're good on time. We have 2 minutes. Okay. So I talked really fast through this part. I mean, again, one of the members of our team who's not here with us today is from the Office of the State Superintendent of Education, and without their help, and I should put the thank you slide up there, without her help, we wouldn't get access to these data in the first place. So, you know, there's a real opportunity there, not only working with her and shaping how the Healthy School Act is sent out to principals and how to get that data to be a little bit more reliable and valid. You know, so, for example, some of the questions that we used to ask the principal about school nutrition, we don't ask anymore because we know we have the school menus. Some other data that we have in terms of the different farm-to-school programs, we know that there's farm-to-school programs, so it's a lot of coordination of data as well. And without a partner at the Office of the State Superintendent, we wouldn't be able to kind of, you know, again, massage the data that we have access to. We also have two fabulous graduate assistants who have helped us on the work, Stephanie George and Michelle Kalicki, and then we also have a partner that has supported this work. The Office of the State Superintendent of Education, as you can imagine, has no money, so they do this research without any help at all. So we're very lucky that the Kaiser Permanente Foundation has given us a little money to look at this outcome. And then the last quick thing that we meant to add a slide about, but we really wanted to say, and we'll drive you to our website if you're interested, is we do hold an annual stakeholder conference. And we put together a video that kind of talks about some of that research. So, again, one of the, again, the powerful things about this community-based research, which is sticky and messy but wonderful, is bringing in the partners, the stakeholders in the schools, the teachers, the parents, who want to tell us, like, well, how should we drive this research? So, yeah, that's a big piece of what we do. So there you go. I've used up my 2 minutes. People can ask questions later.
Thank you.